Yeah, hi Kiki. Hey, thanks for joining us on this project, Spotlight on Members.
Thanks, David. I'm tickled to be here.
Oh, good. Well, it's been fun so far. We've done about 8 of these things, and so we've been enjoying them, and we're going to be sharing them soon. Yeah, so we'll just jump into it. We got a few questions we want to ask you, and one of the first ones is, how did you come to the Dharma, to the Buddhist path of study and practice?
Slowly. I would say it's kind of quickly and slowly. Like, I tripped and fell right into it unintentionally. And then the process, I think, of really understanding what I've fallen into has taken a long time to really understand what it is the Dharma is, rather than a concept, but is a way of being. So I think maybe it was interesting. It was strangely in one of the hardest times of my life that I met Reggie Ray when I was in Colorado. And Reggie was coming up to the mountains, and someone had invited me to come to a talk with him, a weekend. And so I met Reggie in that way and just started to befriend the Dharma in the way in which I was able to start a friendship with him in, like I said, a really difficult time of my life. And I remember Reggie said to me at the end of the weekend, he said, well, you should get yourself up to Shambhala Mountain Center and do a retreat. Mm-hmm. At the time I was married, I had 2 kiddos, and I was thinking, there is no way I could go for even a week away. But that, planting that seed in my mind, and I think maybe that it was like a Datun or something he was teaching. And through Naropa at the time, I had no idea what Naropa was. I had no idea what Buddhism really was. And so that invitation worked on me. Maybe it was 2 or 3 months out, and somehow I just had decided. And so I did. I went up and got 1 week out of that month, and I decided to take that week in silence. That was an option that we could take, and I just had never done anything like that and could not have imagined doing anything like that. But when I got there and I flipped that little sign around that said whatever, noble silence, it was a crazy, especially because I had kids, it was this wonderful experience, probably the first glimpse of, oh wow, I could, whatever this is, I can really get into it. So it was the beginning. I ended up going to Naropa University after that. That just started the process, and then ended up, ended up in that way starting.
Yeah, so finding, you know, a good teacher like Reggie Ray, one of Trungpa Rinpoche's senior students, having some exposure to things, and then actually doing a practice retreat.
Yeah.
Datun. A Datun is like a month-long meditation retreat, right?
Yeah. Of course, I did a week.
In silence, yeah. That sounds like a pretty deep dive right away to do a week-long meditation retreat. So then Naropa University. Yeah. So you joined. What were you doing? A Buddhist studies program, or what were you doing at Naropa?
I did the Master's of Divinity. I knew I had wanted to go back and get my master's degree, and so I had about 60 credits of undergrad, and then I had stopped school in my 20s. And so I went back. I knew I wanted to go back, and I thought about getting a degree in psychology. I wanted to be a teacher maybe. So I went back and started to finish my undergrad. And so I studied with Jane Carpenter Cohen and Frank Berliner, and got my undergrad in Buddhist psychology, and was studying also with Nataraja and doing yoga. So between yoga and psychology, I'd finished my undergrad and then took the Master's of Divinity, decided I was going to do the MDiv at Naropa. So
did that require you to do the Indo-Buddhist studies that, you know, including Natartha at that time?
It included Natartha. So it was it was at the very end of time when Vicky and some of the people that were doing the Masters of Divinity studies we still had to go up to Shambhala Mountain Center, and we had to do our, and we also had to do clinical pastoral education, CPE. So doing the Masters of Divinity, I don't know, it also kind of deepened me in things I otherwise wouldn't have deepened in. When I was doing my undergrad, I was really doing more studying with Shambhala indirectly. And I don't think I really had a heart teaching with Shambhala teachings. I had a real heart connection with being at Naropa and loved what I was studying. And I met Lama Tempa. And then when I went into starting my Masters of Divinity, that's when I was really starting to understand the beginnings of what is Buddhism, rather than just this concept, but as a practice and as a way of life, particularly as a way of community. I think that's what was really neat and new for me, was being able to start creating this intentional kind of community way of living.
So at those times, were you, like, when did you kind of think you were a Buddhist?
And I don't know if I still am a Buddhist, David. I have to be honest with you. I always say, so right now I'm missing her last name. Stephanie's my PI, and I always make jokes like, at least I'm not a very good Buddhist. But more and more, I think, in all honesty, probably in the last couple of years, and maybe so in the last 6 months, I've started to think, maybe I am a Buddhist. And particularly connecting with the Bardo teachings, I've turned 50. So realizing I've spent more years on the planet behind me than I probably have in front of me. And there's just been this radical change in the last, I wouldn't say six, probably the last year, couple of years. You and I have talked about some of the changes. And it's really, some things have really clicked around, strange excitement around going towards the death process and using my life time to teach, to practice, and to be practicing towards the process of dying in a in a way that I think that I'm starting to understand it, like I keep saying that word, experientially. So maybe truly out of the last two decades, maybe in the last couple of years, starting to really understand what it means for me deeply inside of me.
That's really interesting. Well, I've known you for quite a while, and I know you've been interested in other kinds of spiritual practices, and you've tried to integrate those into your life in some different kinds of ways too. So Buddhism is a very important part of that, but you've got some other things like yoga and other practices going on too. Well, what about Panap Rinpoche? When did you make a connection with him in some ways? Was it through Nitartha or something else?
I think I saw him one time at Naropa. He came in like Shambhala Hall. It was one of the last times maybe he taught in person on the campus. And I thought that, I remember the room, it was standing room only, and people were just like puking out into the hallway. They weren't puking out. The room was puking people. And then I really didn't think about it. The fascinating thing is I was one of the last students to do the travel abroad to Sikkim. So I was of the last students that went to Sikkim. We studied with, it'll come to me, and we lived in one of the Rinpoche's houses down in the basement, and he lived up on the top floor. And I still at that time didn't really understand what Buddhism was. And I'm getting to the question of Ponlop Rinpoche, but to me, when I look back, what's amazing about it now is we weren't supposed to leave Sikkim. Our visas weren't meant, we weren't supposed to be traveling around, but I can say this now, many years later, that I had this invitation. One of the teachers said, come to Delhi with us and then we'll go up to Dharamsala and we can get a blessing by the Karmapa. And I was like, all right, sounds like a fun game. So I actually took refuge with the Karmapa up in Dharamsala. And there were just a few of us in the room. And I remember him saying to me as the Westerner, you have to practice. Like Westerners, you just have to practice and then you'll understand Dharma. Then he, you know, whatever, I think bonked me on the head. I got a little weepy. That was the year I was then coming back, and maybe it was the year before I was required to do Nitartha and start, you know, doing some clinical pastoral education work. So I went to Nitartha that first year, and I helped in the bookstore. And then I went back the next year, and that was when I really started to kind of go down the rabbit hole of Nitartha. But that first summer, I got to meet Hunlop Rinpoche, and I don't know if I felt like I had a particular connection with him at the time, but I had a particular connection to being there and to being in the process that we were in. I loved being there. And I remember sitting in front of Rinpoche and asking him to be my teacher. And he said something funny, and he probably had a sense like I had no idea what I was asking for. And I said, you know, Rinpoche, we would be my teacher. And he said, oh, Kiki, we'll see. So I just, you know, that was the beginning. And I kept remembering like, well, we'll see. Well, I guess we'll see. So now I just keep seeing. And it's been just such a lovely and honestly a really beautiful journey to be seeing. Like I just kept repeating that. Well, so when you asked me, how did I know I was a Buddhist? Well, David, we'll see.
Yeah, that's good. Keep your wide open possibilities. Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is all of that invitation, it felt like an invitation into something. And maybe, you know, I had a rough Christian upbringing, you know, kind of brokenhearted by the Christian tradition. And what's turned into being a chaplain at the VA was just kind of like, okay, well, we'll see, you know. And I think back, Reggie invited me to go to that first Datun, and it was kind of like, okay, well, we'll see. And then he told me about Naropa, and then it was, well, we'll see. And then I finished my degree, and then the next degree. And I never thought I was going to be a chaplain, never. But then the next thing turned into the next thing, turned into the next thing. And every step along the way, my heart connection kept growing. And so I would just get more and more committed to, well, we'll see what's next. Well, we'll see what's next. And that inner guru, that inner confidence that just kept building along with the other traditions I was studying. You know, I do a lot of work with the Native American tradition and Sweat Lodge and a lot of work down in South America. And they all kept coming back to Hunlop Rinpoche's invitation to, well, we'll see. And somehow that has turned into none of it's separate for me. It all has really become an integrated experience of Dharma as a way of life, including the work that I have ended up doing as a chaplain.
Yeah, that's good. That's a nice story. Nice way to look at it too. Yeah, and we won't have a lot of time to talk about your work as a chaplain, but we want to have you come back again.
Sure.
And then we can talk some more time about how you're doing that with the up at the VA hospital in Portland, working with vets and in some very significant kinds of ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
So another question we like to ask people too is, do you have a favorite Dharma teaching or teachings? You know, something that really helps you be in the world, helps you with your work. You know, as Douglas says, is kind of a guiding, a North Star, kind of a set of, you know, a way to guide you through life in some ways, that kind of teaching, those kinds of teachings.
I loved when Douglas actually planted that when we were studying, what was that book club we were studying?
The Heart Sutra or the Interconnected
Heart Attack? No, but the Heart Attack Sutra. And he had asked us that. And the first thing that came to my mind then was one particular line in the Bodhisattva vow. And it says, just as with a blind man finding a jewel in a heap of dust, thus somehow the bodhicitta has been born in me. And when I think of that, particularly because I work with people who really struggle with stable mental health, and I think about what is required to have this experience of bodhicitta and to really understand how lucky, like what a fortunate human being we are if we have stable enough mental health to actually study the Dharma, practice it, to understand it. So I work with a lot of people who don't have that luxury, whether from childhood, complex trauma, military sexual trauma, combat trauma, people that either hate themselves, hate others, hate community, or a combination of really deeply seated internalized hatred. It's what keeps me when I see somebody who also hates me, but doesn't want to hate me, you know? They want support and help. It's what keeps me really open-hearted, I think, and compassionate to all beings, realizing, just as with a blind man in a jewel of heap of dust, somehow I'm lucky enough to have a stable enough mind to know that what others maybe can't do, I can. And because I can, I don't feel obligated in my head, but I feel absolutely inspired in my heart to do this work as a result. So I think that's the way that the Bodhisattva vow really inspires me, is that others can't do what we do. But maybe it's kind of, we've talked about this too, like a battery. Our love or our compassion, our willingness to do our own work can actually offer space and maybe even get someone else jump-started into a mental stable of mind with just that kindness and friendship. So I think that's the one. I mean, and I think that that then dominoes into many teachings, especially the four, when I contemplate the four reminders, I come back to, wow, how lucky I am to know that this life is precious. Because a lot of people, they don't have that feeling. They don't think life is precious. Their life isn't precious. They're more interested in not being here and more inspired in contemplating not being here. So I think that one teaching then inspires so many other teachings for me to just keep diving in, which, like I said, we'll see has turned into, and maybe it's all part of that, this really being inspired by end of life, end of life studies. So,
yeah, well, again, we'll talk some more about your chaplain's work, but I'm really struck too when you're saying this, you know, about how much, in other people that you're working with, how much hurt those people have, you know, how much trauma they have, how much anger they have, all this, and how you have to, you know, be there in some ways with them, being ready to help them and so on, but being exposed to an awful lot of, a lot of people, you know, people with a lot of negativity in their lives going on. Yeah. So, I mean, it draws upon, I mean, you really have to, seems like you have to draw upon your own compassionate heart, you know, to really be able to step out there and help people like that on an ongoing basis, you know, day in, day out.
Yeah, sure it does. Yeah. Keep in my practice, that's for sure.
Yeah, real, a real strong Mahayana path for sure. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, it's the time of COVID and time of the pandemic and so on. But you're working almost, you are working full time, right?
Yeah.
And basically you're an essential worker. I remember talking way back in March and you were going to the hospital and at some point you were able to work at home, but you're doing outreach programs. So how are you doing? How are you doing with this time of the pandemic? But again, it seems like you're working a lot. So maybe it's not exactly normal, but you're out there.
I am out there, David. In whenever it was it March that really this?
Yeah, March is when they started to close everything down. And keep people home.
Almost overnight, they sent more than 75% of the people home from the hospital, and they didn't send me home. And initially, it was just sort of traumatic to be there as an essential worker, just to witness how distressed that the staff. So part of my work as an outpatient mental health chaplain, a third of my work was already focused towards staff care, and then two-thirds of my work is outpatient mental health, moral injury, PTSD. Overnight, my job went to, I would say, 90% staff care, because the infrastructure to do all online wasn't there yet. So just the mental health, the mental health providers that already had VA computers and stuff that they could go home, the system was set up for them, and the online system. So my job just radically transitioned to staff care, staff distress. I'm also a whole health chaplain. So point two of my job is particularly focused on whole health principles. And so we were writing programming immediately around resiliency. We were just, we were doing like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday for almost 8 weeks by the chief of staff. They asked us to be sitting with these nurses and these doctors. So we would have, 10 or 15 people at a time that would come in the big auditorium. Everyone's got their masks on. Everybody's trying to figure out the protocol. People are distressed because the answer is a moving target anyway. So we were just there doing what's not inspiring, what's inspiring, how to work with a compassionate heart, how to allow people to have what I call tiny little grief snacks. So like tiny little bits of grief and then get them back out there. So it felt kind of like we were almost, a lot of people were saying like, almost like we were in the military. It was like, get them fluffed up and get them back working with them. So my job really became about, we would do like 8 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 7 p.m. Three days a week that we were just doing staff care. So I say all that because it was actually, first it was distressing, then it was exhilarating, and then 2 months went by, and then I was burnt out. And then I got sent home. And so it took probably a month of really pulling way back. I did a lot of grieving myself, and I was setting up shop here at home. And so just giving myself permission to dive deeply back into practice and doing a lot of grieving. You and I started talking. I was able to come back and sit with the Sangha via Zoom. So I think that community piece really then helped me to do some of my grieving that I probably wasn't aware that I was doing. And then just deepening of my practice. And so I say all that because I know we're probably coming to the end of our time, but I think now I'm doing maybe better than I've ever done. Because I have always taught about grief, but really, really sitting in the guts of grief with practice, with sharing that with people. And when people aren't distressed, it's like, uh-oh, here comes the chaplain. But it was really incredible to see a group of people who were grateful to have a place to grieve. So there was a real, there was just an incredible also transition kind of in my career, my work, that I was able to come back home and feel like this is good work. This is good work that I never intended to do. But as a result of that, as a result of being able to be back with Colorado community and then deepening in practice, strangely delighted. There's a weird kind of freedom and delight in my own life right now. It's gotten quiet, really quiet. Life has gotten simple. It's doing well.
Yeah, that's quite a journey, in terms of the intensity around the pandemic and the COVID and dealing already with other people had certain kinds of traumas and so on too. Yeah. And I like what you say about community, Kiki. I know you pretty well, and I know that's a very important part of that. So it's really nice that you do have this connection with us here in Colorado. And one benefit of the pandemic thing has been we can do Zoom things and you can kind of feel connected as well as everybody else, whether you live here or live someplace else. Yeah.
I want to say this last piece. A lot of people, I think, have lived in either or, good, bad, right, wrong. And I believe Buddhism teaches us to not live in that kind of And so people have unintentionally been forced out of good, bad, right, and wrong, right? Like we can't blame the pandemic on anybody. So it's really drawn them into holding what I call irreconcilable tension. And it's evened the playing field, strangely. I don't, even when I say that, I'm not quite sure, but it seems to have done something to a lot of human beings that makes even speaking about Buddhism or about this as either as a religion or as a philosophy or as a way of life, people are more, including myself, open to really living and understanding. And I in understanding this. And it's kind of been like a lot of stuff that's not very inspiring, and a lot of stuff that's strangely very inspiring, and learning to hold that irreconcilable tension.
Yeah. Very nice. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. So I'd really love to come back and spend some more time talking about what you're doing at the VA hospital. One of the things I heard that you were doing was using Carl's book, The Heart Attack Sutra, with one of your outreach groups. And that just amazes me, you know, so learning more about that would be really cool. Sure. Yeah. So thanks for joining us on our Spotlight with Members program here, our project. It's been really wonderful talking to you and learning a little bit more too about your life, even though I know you pretty well and spent some time with you at Natartha and so on. Yeah.
David, yeah. Thanks for doing this. Thanks to both you and Douglas. I'm grateful. I think it's going to be a great project. So I'm also tickled that you guys are doing this and feel, I don't know, it sounds silly, but maybe I feel really, really proud of you guys.
So. Yeah. Well, I appreciate your support and some of the energy you loan out to us, or however you do that in charging our batteries. Yeah. So very good. Okay. Thanks, Iggy. Well, take care, and we'll be back in touch with you too. So I'm going to